Hi, I'm Zahn Valines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. I'm here today with Dr. Joanne Finkelstein, a psychologist and expert on talking to children about sexism and other issues of justice. Patriarchy teaches men a script for how to treat women, but it also teaches women a script about how to respond and what to accept. Parents are often the first teachers of this script. Perhaps this is why one of the most common questions I get from readers is how to raise feminist, empowered daughters. Joanne and I originally recorded a podcast about raising feminist kids a few weeks ago, and then my computer decided to attempt a homicide and delete the whole thing. So this is actually our second conversation, but I'm really glad that we're having it because now we're doing this in the wake of the election when a lot of parents who are terrified are scrambling to talk to kids who are terrified. And I think that Joanne is the perfect person to guide us through this process. So Joanne, I'm so happy to have you here.
I'm so glad to be back on, especially at this time.
So, I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about Joanne first. Joanne Finkelstein is a clinical psychologist and the author of Sexism and Sensibility, Raising Empowered, Resilient Girls in the Modern World. She was educated at Harvard University and Northwestern University and now maintains a private clinical practice rooting in an understanding of how bias, social justice, and mental health intersect. Dr. Finkelstein serves on the advisory board for Stop Sexual Assault in Schools. Has served on the board of the Chicago chapter of the National Organization for Women, volunteered for Planned Parenthood Political Action Committee, and was an organizer for the Chicago Women's March. She lives in Chicago, Illinois. I'll put all of her links as well as information about how to buy her new book in the show notes. And I just want to note that this book is really worth buying. I know there are so many self-help books about parenting out there, but Joanne's book is so information dense and it gives you really practical, usable scripts that you can implement right away. And you really feel like you have a coach who understands how to handle these really thorny topics. So it's called Sexism and Sensibility, and you should go buy it right now. Joanne, like I said, I love your book. I love you. I love the work you're doing. And I think that you are the right person to talk to about this election. So let's just begin with what the fuck?
What the actual fuck?
It's so scary. And I think, there's so much ground to cover, but one of the things that I think needs sort of an urgent intervention is that no matter who won this election, we have a problem in this culture. Trump did not spring out of nowhere. And even if he lost, we would have this world of racist, sexist, violent men to contend with. So, I think people need to keep that in mind that we didn't have a choice between a perfect world and a terrible one. We had a choice between two pretty challenging worlds, and we chose the more challenging one, unfortunately.
Sexism, racism, xenophobia, it wasn't all going to disappear if Kamala Harris just got elected, like we'd hoped.
And, I think one of the few perhaps positive aspects of the Trump election is that it's really going to test all the things that he's saying he wants to do and show his followers what can actually happen. And then this also puts pressure on the left to really rise to this challenge and talk to our kids and raise a generation of activists who are prepared to push back on whatever is to come. That's how I'm framing this to my kids because I don't know what else to do. Joanne, how are you framing this to your kids?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question and a really important question. My sort of guiding framework is to think of that quote, right, that says to be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing, which is really hard to do when you're feeling so much despair as a parent. But, we all know it's important for parents to manage their own reactions constructively. Right. And so I've got both going on. I've got in my kids, right? One that's panicking and one that's saying, well, it's just 4 more years. Right. And there's a part of me that really wants to disabuse that child of that notion that it's only 4 more years. But I don't really want to do that. I want to do it slowly. right? Like my whole book is all about sort of using teachable moments and playing the long game. And so my goal is to make sure my kids don't panic, but that they do know that there are things that they can do to get involved, to fight back, to make sure that they're living in a world that holds the same values that they hold.
I think that's great advice. And I think another thing to consider is one of the things that's really challenging about talking to parents about how we talk to our kids is that every family situation is really different. If you're talking about a family where there's an undocumented immigrant in the family, the level of fear and the sorts of issues that you're going to have to address are very different than, white American middle class citizens. And I think that that is particularly important for white American middle class citizens to remember. One of the pieces of advice that I have been giving people is that we really need to be realistic about our personal level of exposure. And if we are in the low risk group, and that does include women to some extent, even though we are going to see so many rights stripped away, but we're not going to be put in camps if we are white and middle class. We're not going to be deported to a country we've never lived in. We have fewer concerns about police brutality and injustice, and we need to be honest with ourselves about that because if we have that privilege, then we have to weaponize that privilege against these abusive systems rather than wallowing in our own fear. We cannot treat this like a football game that we're sad we lost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're reminding me of those, videos on those reels on Instagram and TikTok with Black women saying, fuck the blue bracelets, right? You're not this team of good doers, right? Or, this team who has to know who's safe and who's not safe. What you need to do, like, we don't need your protection. What we need you to do is use your privilege to talk to those other white people and those other privileged people who voted against their own, voted against their own and our rights and best interests, right? And I've had this conversation with my kids, right, that we're lucky. We're going to be protected for now, at least. But it's our responsibility to use that privilege as a tool against the system that granted us that privilege.
Yeah, it's so important. I have two very anxious kids. One is a toddler who doesn't really understand what's happening. She just understands that it's scary. And then I have a very politically engaged second grader. And I was really scared to tell her that she had one. And so my husband and I talked a lot about what we were going to tell her. And what we finally arrived at is nothing about your life is going to change. You are safe. We will be with you. We will love you. Everybody in your life will love you no matter what. But we know people whose lives are going to change, and we know people whose lives might change. And because you are safe, you have a moral obligation to stand up for them. And I sort of watched her spine stiffen when I said that to her. I watched her transition from someone who was scared and defeated to someone who felt like she had some power to help other people. And I think that kids really thrive on being given the power to be positive influences.
Oh, that is such a beautiful way that you put it to her. And I think that really gets to the heart of being able to give them hope and a sense of empowerment. Right? Like, we want to get across to them that what's so much of what's right about our country hasn't actually come from the government, but from people standing up to injustice. And there's millions of examples that we can pull from to show that, to illustrate that.
Yeah, I love that. So, can you tell me a little bit? I know that you're still in clinical practice. Tell me what you're seeing with people, what people are experiencing, and also what you're observing in terms of effective strategies for talking to kids, both strategies that are effective for supporting kids, but that are also effective for like really encouraging critical thinking and a social justice mindset.
I am seeing everything across the board. The most challenging sessions I've had have been with people who support Trump. And it's, of course, easier to relate to people that have much more similar politics to me. But so I've had a lot of teenage girls that are crying. But it's also sort of interesting and diagnostic when somebody doesn't even bring it up. And so I think one of the important things to remind our daughters, right, is that one reason that these men were elected is because of the strength that women truly hold, right? Our collective power is intimidating to people who aren't ready for change and growth. And that was, I mean, I don't know that I would add this part in, but that is, how witches were born, right? That, smart, intelligent, threatening women were labeled witches. And so now that we understand our collective power, we really have to stand with other women. And that means not turning our backs on women who voted for Trump, right? I'm actually putting out a newsletter tomorrow that's in the midst of writing, and it's talking about the psychological reasons why women may have voted for Trump. And, one, there's several reasons that I surmise, and one of them is, internalized misogyny. So if we have been talking throughout their growing up years what misogyny is, why we might absorb it and come to believe some of these things about ourselves, right? The hope is that they are going to be able to question sexism, not internalize it, and not grow up to people who can't imagine voting for a woman, or especially a black woman.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I did an interview with Desiree Stevens a couple of months ago, who is an incredible racial justice educator. And pretty much the drumbeat that Desiree has been pounding for the last 2 weeks is pleading with white people to not do this thing where you refuse to talk to Trump supporters. She argues that we have to connect with their humanity so that we can pull them into our circle of humanity. And that doing that is really the only hope for change, and that alienating them just intensifies their beliefs. I would add to what she has said that feminism is for all women, and that women who are Trump supporters will also be victimized under Trump, have been victimized under our misogynistic system. And perhaps most interestingly, my own internal data suggests to me that between 5 and 10% of the women who subscribe to my explicitly feminist Black Lives Matter far left-wing newsletter voted for Trump. And
Wow.
you're the expert on human thoughts and behavior. Tell me what to make of that.
I think that goes along partly with the identification with internalized misogyny, but I also think that there's this identification with the aggressor stuff going on. Right. So the identification with the aggressor, right? It's a defense mechanism where someone facing oppression or victimization begins to empathize or identify with the source of their distress, right? And then over time, they might adopt characteristics of or behaviors of that person. And we're seeing that right now since the election, right? Like, think your body, my choice. But in any case, I think, that, it's a strategy for feeling less powerless and helps explain why people show tolerance of or collusion with bullies, right? And it's not just women who experience it. People of all genders can experience it. But since women are more powerless in our culture, aligning with powerful figures and adopting biases against their own sex can allow them to feel that they're part of the dominant group, where they, believe, or they can convince themselves that they won't be targeted or judged. I think even if women are put off by his offensive language and certain policies, it feels safe and empowering to join them. And one more thing, I think it also, this is kind of the creepier part, it also feels exciting. And the reason I say that is in some ways, right, we can all relate to the wish to break the rules, defy authority, especially as women maybe who have been conditioned for so long to be agreeable and, to have heard repeatedly that their anger is crazy. So when you see someone who can so brazenly flout social norms, right, he might appeal to those transgressive wishes that we all have, but especially in conservative women who may have more deeply internalized the restrictions imposed on them from a young age.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight that I hadn't even considered. I also think that we can't underestimate the role of victim blaming. I've often said that we engage in victim blaming so we can feel safe. If I don't do those bad things, then bad things won't happen to me.
Yes.
And I think, these women are aligning themselves with power. One of the more interesting insights I've heard comes from my husband, who's a civil rights attorney. So he litigates a lot of prison deaths, police abuse, really, really violent, upsetting stuff that's obviously very politicized. And one of the things that he has said is that often on a jury, you don't want someone who has experienced similar violence or worse violence than your client, because they may consider your client a whiner, or they may look at your client and say, here are the things that this person did to cause it, because in separating themselves from the person who's been victimized, they're allowed to sort of re-empower themselves and feel a sense of safety. And I do hear a lot from conservative women, oh, these left-wing women are just whiners, they're overreacting, they're hyperbolic, it's not that bad. And a lot of that comes from these women having experienced really brutal abuse at the hands of men and not connecting that personal experience to the political realities they're voting for.
I mean, I think that's such a good point and so true, right? And I think that also comes from it's part of internalized misogyny, where you grow up and you learn that you want to be any kind of girl but that girl, and that girl is basically just a girl, right? And so we learn to disidentify with people in our own sex and gender. And say, well, we're not like that. I'm not like that. I'm not a whiner. I'm not going to complain. So yeah, 100%. Patriarchy does, right? It does its most effective work when it turns women against each other, making them afraid to be feminist and encouraging competition and distrust between them, and make anybody who stands up from them for themselves a whiner. But you were going to ask.
So, well, on that point, something that a lot of my readers say they're struggling with is their sons are getting or have been radicalized. And some of them also have daughters who are like moderates or even Trump supporters. And that's a really hard position to be in as a parent, because then you get into a space where you're like trying to impose your values on your kids, and then they're rebelling against them, and you get more and more panicked about who is this person going to grow up to be. Talk to me about talking to kids who have these reactionary views. What can or should parents do?
Oh, it's such a hard one. I have a son who, he voted for Kamala, and he is he's he thinks Trump is a complete ass, but he's more moderate than I am, and he has watched all the Logan Paul stuff and Joe Rogan stuff, and he's a news junkie, so he watches all of it from all sides. And the minute that Trump was on Joe Rogan and he was listening, and Trump was funny and ha, and he said it is going to be a big mistake that Kamala didn't go on Joe Rogan. And so I'm just saying that, and he was right, you know, he really called it. And so I'm saying all this is that it can feel like we are no match for social media, but all we can do is keep on talking about what we know to be true, and that is that men are having a lot of trouble these days. They're lonely. They are not well. Like, we can empathize with all the things that men and probably many of those sons you're talking about are feeling, but that women are being used as a scapegoat for their problems. They are saying because women have gained more equality and have made progress, men are doing worse, boys are doing worse. And that's just not the case, right? That we have to, that equality is important for everybody. And hopefully that is a, even if they've been pulled in by the manosphere, hopefully, you know, your friends, values of that everybody deserves equality has seeped in some, and so that they can say to their kids, like, men have to learn to adapt to equality. And just because women are progressing, it doesn't mean men have to regress, but we all have to learn to adapt and be in relationship with each other. So I think that it's there's not an easy answer, and I wish I could just say A, B, and C, but just to know you're playing the long game, not to give up, to say how you feel and have many conversations about it, but don't devolve into shaming them, because that's where we lose them. And it's so easy for any of us. I mean, I've had, you know, even before the election, I was fighting with my son about things, and it was like I had to bite my tongue 10 times. And honestly, through our conversations, I can see how much, you know, and through sending him my newsletters and stuff, I can see how much more empathy he's developed for, you know, friends of his and me and other women he knows who are really, really sad about what happened in this election and what it says about our culture.
Yeah. You know, it's you mentioned your son. So I have a child in my family, not one of my kids, but someone who I play like a parental role to, who is a Trump supporter. Now, fortunately, she's too young to vote, thank God. But I find that my first impulse with her is always the kind of shaming, punitive thing of, well, you know, that I'm just not going to pay for you to get your nails done then. And well, I'm just not going to talk to you because it's just so frustrating and enraging. But I think then it gives her something to rebel against, and it becomes kind of rewarding of like, well, this mean person in my family, you know, doesn't understand me, but you know, all my Trump friends do. And I think we also, the thing that she's told me, you know, I have resisted my punitive impulses with her, though I have to like take a lot of deep breaths. The thing that she says over and over again is that Trump is funny and interesting. And I think that we cannot underestimate the power of the weaponization of coolness. You know, it's really easy to be cool and funny when you don't give a shit about anybody else and when you're not offended by racism and sexism. And I think our side then just looks like uninteresting and uncool. And like, I don't know how to be cool in that.
We looked so buttoned up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's part of the like identification with the aggressor or transgressor, right? Like the clan or the class clown, right? They're kind of the one who stands out, and they're funny, and part of you wishes, you know, part of her probably wishes that she could just be free to say whatever's on her mind. But
I think that's totally it. And we just also cannot underestimate how social media is priming and grooming these kids. So my husband's main hobby is fitness. He's like a fitness bro, even though he's like a far leftist. So the only thing he ever really looks at on YouTube are like fitness videos. There's, you know, not a lot of politics. That's not how he consumes political stuff. But then if you go to his YouTube homepage and see what the algorithm is feeding him solely based on his interest in fitness, it is like all manosphere stuff. It's so easy to get access to that stuff. And then once you get it, you start bathing in it and it becomes normalized.
Yeah. No, I don't think we should underestimate it at all. I think that is a big component of what won the election for Trump supporters. I mean, I find it really interesting, right? Because we are supposed to be the quote unquote progressive party, and they're the ones who manage to use technology to their advantage.
Yes. And so I don't. My kids are too young to really have like solo access to tablets or computers or anything like that. But I'm thinking about it more as my second grader is getting older. How do we, I don't even know how to ask the question, what do, Joanne? Like, tell me what to do about this because it's all toxic, but we don't want to be these like controlling, overbearing parents. How do we balance that and somewhat protect them while encouraging critical thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is about oh, what does Devorah Heitner always say? Monitor, not, oh, I can't remember. But in any case, we want to, we don't, you know, we don't want to control our kids'
Right.
use because they're just going to set up secret Snapchats or Finstas or whatever they call it, right? And so it's all in the conversation that you're having outside of social media. And of course, as they're growing up, you're going to want to monitor a little bit what they're looking at, ch check their feeds, just, you know, explain algorithms to them. And that, you know, the algorithms are basically picking up on what their insecurities are. So, you know, if they're, I mean, this is a little off topic, but it's the same principle, right? If they are worried about their skin and they're looking at TikToks about their skin, algorithm is going to see that they are ripe for advertisements that say you have all these flaws and here are all these ways to fix it, right? And same thing if men are watching stuff on loneliness or fitness or whatever about what it means to be a man, they're going to be fed that. And so we really want to make sure kids really understand that what they're seeing is not all of what's out there, but it's what is being targeted to them. And then I think, you know, as your kids get older, it's very, very hard to know what's going on. And I think we got lucky that my son is very, you know, he talks to us a lot. And so he has been telling us the kinds of videos that he sees on these platforms for a long time, which gave us the opportunity to have real conversations about that. And, you know, if he had, and he has said this is true, that he could have potentially gone the other way had he had different parents who didn't talk a lot about human rights and who weren't both therapists and who didn't hear what he was listening to and take that to task again in the least defensive ways we possibly could. And I do not say we were always successful, but we knew that it was crucial to kind of hear what he was saying, hear what he thought was funny about Trump, and then sort of give our point of view about why that might not be so funny.
I think that's really helpful. You know, you saying that reminds me of this book I just started reading. It's by David Yeager. It's called 10 to 25. I haven't even finished it yet, but it's about motivating young people. And he has this really interesting story about like quit smoking campaigns and how until the mid 1990s, all of the CDC's smoking cessation campaigns actually increased smoking rates. And all of these campaigns were basically instructive. They were telling young people what to do. Don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke. Smoking is bad. And then they started that truth campaign that I think came to life when I was a teenager, where it was like teenagers protesting tobacco companies. And they were framing not smoking as counterculture and as independent thinking. And as something young people could do to push back against adults who were trying to force them to do something, which was smoke. And it was really successful. And he argues that, you know, young people of course, want to feel independent and they want to feel like their opinions are valued. And so when we're just telling them what to do and what to think, they're more likely to rebel against that. And I'm not sure exactly how we can use that in talking to our kids about politics, but I think that insight might be helpful in just, asking
Absolutely.
like, how can I talk to my kid in a way where I am not being the overbearing, all-controlling parent or, other family figure?
And it's right. We want to bring up good kids. And so when they come to us with these offensive, what we consider offensive ideas about humanity, it's really hard not to scoff and not to, feel like a bad parent and haven't I taught you anything? And what kind of person are you going to turn out to be? And your mind might go to all those places, but really, like taking that deep breath, really trying to empathize with them and where they might be getting this information and talking to them like they are somebody with a brain because they are, I think we're, you're going to get so much farther that way than just getting defensive and growling.
So, speaking about controlling our emotions, one of the things that you and I talked a bit about before the podcast is parents sort of projecting their own fears onto their kids. And what I'm seeing in my circle a lot, because my circle is almost like exclusively far leftist activists, is parents making wild predictions about what is going to happen in a Trump administration. And then, under the guise of I'm informing my child, telling their children, Trump voters voted to have you killed. There are going to be death camps and you're going to go. I think that's obviously not helpful. I also think that it's really important for parents to hear that generally predicting the future, and particularly predicting a harmful future, is not good for anybody because none of us know what is going to happen. But can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm glad you that we sort of circled back to this because I know you were asking before about what are some things that we can am I seeing in my practice and what can we talk to kids about. Like I said, I think it's so important for parents to manage their own reactions constructively, right? And show kids how to focus on actionable responses rather than despair, right? Like you might say, I'm disappointed. You see, I'm crying. But after a few days or a few weeks, I'm going to focus on ways that we can still make a difference in our community. Right? Kids, especially kids in elementary school, they really need a focus on reassurance. Especially when the world feels uncertain, children need to be certain that they're cared for and loved. Right? And, you were saying, look, we do not know what is going to happen, all right? And so one of the things that I said to my daughter is that not everything a candidate promises will happen. So while we need to worry and while we need to believe what people say, there isn't reason for panic right now. Right?
Yeah.
And for older kids, right, action can be so empowering, right? As they can help them find ways to feel empowered, like joining a local organization that supports the causes that they're passionate about, so that they have a place to put their negative feelings to positive action, right? Or, maybe they want to start a human rights club at school or donate some of their allowance or get involved in local politics. Like, there's so much that we really can and need to be doing. And so I think being, the urgency around doing rather than the urgency around despair is what's important.
I love it that you mentioned local politics in particular. This is something I've really been harping on with people, is that we pay the least attention to local politics, but that's actually the stuff that is most likely to affect your daily life. It's local politicians who oversee your county jail, who oversee your school system, who oversee your police department. And you
It's
can affect
judges
them.
who are making decisions about your abortion.
You can affect so much change at the local level, and especially to my audience who are, seeking restraining orders, seeking divorces, seeking child custody, it's all local judges who are often running unopposed. Third parties have a lot of great luck at the local level, because no one pays attention. So I would just really encourage people to pay attention to what is happening with their local politics. And I would also, to piggyback on what you said about not operating from a place of panic and fear, I think sometimes panic can feel like activism, and trying to convince people that something bad is going to happen can feel like activism, because the thought process is, if I convince someone that this is really, really, really bad, then they'll change somehow. But when you are operating from a place of panic, you actually become dangerous to other people. When you think that the authorities are coming for you, you're more likely to turn in your neighbor. You're less likely to take a stand for other people.
And like you were pointing out, right, for some people, the authorities might really be coming for them imminently, and so their panicking is more, is more reasonable. And yet bringing your children on board to that is not going to be helpful.
Well, and
Right. It's not good.
I think that we should, anybody who has any degree of privilege needs to be thinking about what they can do to provide immediate support to people in their community. The immigrant that you're friends with, now might be the time that they need to get their immigration paperwork in order, and maybe money is the main barrier. Maybe you can help them with that.
Live in a red state and you can afford abortion medication, right? You can buy this provisional medication in case somebody you know needs it.
In terms of people who really do have a lot to fear from this administration, and I think the people I would most highlight are undocumented immigrants and immigrants who don't have any kind of permanent residency, as well as people who are currently under oversight by the criminal justice system, people who are on probation or parole. What do you recommend for supporting their kids, because they are going to have really hard conversations?
I don't think it's that different than what we're telling any kids, right? In terms of balancing the darkness with hope, but also needing to be very realistic about their situation, that this could happen, but we are going to stand together every step of the way. We are going to fight. We are going to remain a community. I mean, I don't know that I'm so much in a position to be giving, an undocumented worker, advice. And I feel like so many of them know, like have had to deal with racism and fear their whole lives, and that they probably know better than I do about how to talk to their kids.
Part of the challenge is that different people are going to have different conversations. What I would recommend to everyone, regardless of the conversations that you are having, is no matter what your concern is, there is already going to be an organization doing good work on those concerns. So try to connect with those organizations, especially connect with organizations who are led by the people most affected by the issue. White-led anti-racist organizations are a shit show. You want to go with organizations led by non-white people. In my state, for example, there's an organization called the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, and they have done all kinds of work on immigration human rights. And there are similar organizations across the country, probably across the world, I don't know. That you can hook up with, and you can volunteer, you can donate money. If you need help, you can call hotlines and get resources from these organizations. I think now is a good time for people to familiarize themselves with what resources are out there and see what the people running those organizations have to teach them. Because so often in activism, we end up with 30 people doing 30 different things instead of coming together to support a cause that the experts are already working on.
Yeah, that's something I've been saying. Like, pick your issue, pick one issue, and this isn't the time to be reinventing the wheel. There are really strong organizations out there that need your resources, that need your hands, you need your boots on the ground.
Another thing to that point, and this isn't much relevant to talking to kids, but I think it's just good activist advice, is I've been an activist for my whole life and have done what I can on these issues. And like, I'm not the best person or the greatest person, but like, I try. And what I found the morning after the election is I suddenly felt a lot of pressure to like advertise that activism to make sure that the people around me knew that I was doing enough. And I remember that feeling in 2016 too, of the pressure to like perform your activism. So I would just encourage people to check that impulse to focus on doing the next best thing ahead of them rather than making sure people know they're doing it. And also to check the impulse to police what other people are doing. I think that that is only detrimental to assess whether someone is a good enough activist. It's only detrimental to tell other people they're not doing enough to change the world or what they should be doing, because none of us really know what other people are doing or what their situation is.
Right. And I think that's part of what this administration wants, right? Is the hope that we will feel hopeless and turn on each other. And we can't let that happen.
Yeah, I saw this just bonkers conversation in an activist group, where someone posted a pretty innocuous question about like what the safest investments would be in a Trump administration. And then some guy responded and it was like, well, the banks are going to crash, the stock market is going to crash, the housing market is going to crash, and there won't be money anyway, so it doesn't matter. And then like 400 people joined in to agree that nothing we do matters because everything is going to end all on the same day. And there were a few people disagreeing who were just getting trounced and told what awful people they are. It was bizarre. It was totally dystopian, and it's exactly what the right wing wants.
Exactly. And it's the opposite of what you're saying. It was like the people who are saying you're not doing enough. They're the people who are like, why are you even bothering? And of course we have to bother, right? This is, of course we have to believe, right? I'm not willing to panic, but I'm not willing to ignore the promises of Trump and Vance and Project 2025, because that is how authoritarian, totalitarian regimes are born, by people that just hope that nothing bad will really come of it.
Well, and I think, I am not willing to ignore my obligation to help other people. I'm not willing to give up on my own life and my own kids' lives either. I think even on the worst times in history, some people survived and they came together and rebuilt and built something better. And even if that's what we're heading for, there have to be some of us who are going to be there and resist and build something better. And I also think that there is a genuine possibility that this becomes a massive lesson for people and an opportunity to really, truly rebuild, because I do think that some people voted for Trump as a signal that they've just had it with everything about our system. And, we'll see what comes of it. I don't pretend that I know what's going to happen. And I think that anybody who is telling you with certainty that they know what's going to happen is someone who's not trustworthy.
Right. I mean, the one thing that we do know will happen is that it will embolden misogynists and racists, right? And we're already seeing that. And so I think that's where we start.
We start there. And, I just can't help but saying that one of the best ways that women can protect themselves from misogyny is by not getting into relationships with misogynists. Men have far fewer opportunities to control women when those women don't have their kids. So I think we really, really need to buckle down on talking to our daughters about relationships and not romanticizing romance, marriage, men, flowers, all of it.
I mean, I have a big section in my book about that, right? About not emphasizing relationships for girls in ways that we really don't for boys, because then they grow up feeling like they feeling pressured to be in relationships with boys who have not spent their whole life fantasizing about this. And like the inequality is inborn from the second they get in relationship with that person.
Yeah, that's totally the dynamic is that relationships benefit men at women's expense, but women are the ones who are taught to value relationships and men are the ones taught to devalue relationships. So men, of course, devalue their partners and pretend that their partners are doing nothing and mistreat them. And it's just, it's this terrible cycle that I know both you and I have talked a lot about, but we've got to hunker down and really, really stop doing this to our daughters with princess stuff and the wedding stuff and the fairy.
Right, all the benevolent sexism stuff that really says in heterosexual romantic relationships, women are passive, men are active. Even though, women are doing everything, but like they are supposed to be taking this passive role and waiting around and hoping. And yeah, it becomes an unbalanced, ugly, ugly situation.
Yeah. I was so the same kid in my family who's a Trump supporter yesterday said something to me like, why would you ever be unhappy? You're married. And I just I internally fell to the ground screaming and stabbing myself. But I was like, well, yeah, like I'm happily married. And then I finally composed myself and I said, can you think of anybody else who has a marriage that you want, like anybody else in the whole world? And she was like, no. And I was like, so maybe it's not that I'm married that's the reason I'm happy. And she sort of rolled her eyes and scoffed and got back on her phone. So I don't know how much got in
I
through
think
like.
these things are like slowly but surely, like that was a great intervention, right? And it's not completely lost. And she's not going to let you know if she's in the stage of scoffing and going back on her phone. She's not going to let you know what impact you're having. That's why I always say we're playing the long game and to not give up. But yeah, I mean, it's the whole like happy marriages make people happy. Marriage doesn't make people happy.
Yeah, exactly. And most marriages aren't happy. Like, just say it. Just put it on a sticky note and say it to them as much as possible. And it makes me just bonkers that we still are not explicit with girls about this.
Yeah, I think we need to be really, I mean, we're in a different topic now, but I think we do need to be really explicit about what a good relationship looks like, right? And it's
Yeah.
not one conversation, but it's lots of conversations, and it's all the whole bell hooks, love is a verb, right? Because we do them no favors when we make it seem like it's this intangible, romantic, sort of thing that just happens and makes you feel a certain way. It's like, no, somebody who says they care but doesn't behave like they care, that is not love.
Right. So, okay, talk to me about how to actually have those conversations because my kids are still at the age where they think I'm the greatest thing ever and I can just be instructive with them. Like I tell them something, they believe it. But I know that's not always going to be the case, and it's certainly not the case with like the teenagers I interact with. So, how do we teach kids? Like how do we help them learn this?
Again, it's just through long, through conversations that you're having over time, right? About what a good relationship looks like, what kindness looks like.
For people who are not in good relationships, either actively or who are divorced from their children's parents, that's really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, right, it's I was going to say, right, that we can talk about maybe why the relationship was bad, but if it is your child's parent, you probably cannot do that. And I would not suggest you do that until they're much older, right? But I think we can suggest that they pay attention to what matters, right? Like, and we can give our own examples, right? He gets my humor. She memorizes how much milk I take in my coffee. They put their phone away to listen to what's upsetting me. Or, I was once in this relationship with somebody who was really intimidated by my personal growth, and that wasn't going to be okay because I really need someone who helps me grow. And then you can explore with them what matters to them, right? And are they getting that from their partner? Or is their partner willing to be patient because they have to work at the school newspaper every weekend? Or are they going to make them feel guilty for having a job they really love? One of the things that I discussed, and I think I talk about it in the book too, with my daughter that I felt was really important, I was kind of like waiting for the moment, was the whole dynamic of the unavailable guy, the unavailable man, and how women are so attracted to that. So I think the story was something like it came up because she said something like that cats gravitate to those who give them the least attention, and I was like, oh, now's my moment. And so I said, oh, like people. And she looked at me and sort of said, no, I like people who like me the most. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. That's how it should be, And then I pulled out that old Groucho Marx quote, I don't want to belong to any club that will accept me as a member or some version of that, to explain how low self-esteem can cause us to reject people who like us romantically and instead lead us to want people who aren't capable of answering our emotional needs. And I asked her why she thought that would be. And she was so insightful. I think she said something like, some people feel powerful when they can fix other people. And then I added my two cents. I was like, yeah, that's exactly it. And also, it makes them feel special if they're the one who this unavailable person finally gives his heart to. And so we're just having these conversations over time with our kids about what bad relationships look like and what they can grow out of.
I think it can be really subtle. So I have a 14-year-old sister who often asks me for relationship advice. And she just broke up with her first boyfriend a couple of months ago. She's on to her next boyfriend already. So it's no great tragedy. But she like hopped in the car with me one day and she was like, "Well, I broke up with my boyfriend." And I was like, "That's great news. I'm so glad that you got rid of something that wasn't working for you." And she seemed like really taken aback for a second. And then she seemed really happy and then just proceeded to tell me like why she broke up with him. And then I like circled back and I was like, "Okay, why did you seem happy that I said that?" And she was like, "Because everyone else has been like, oh no, he's such a nice guy. Are you sure he doesn't deserve another chance?" And then assumed that like she was really upset and had been sort of shaping it such that like she should be upset. So, I have many moments with her where I'm like, I missed an opportunity, but that was one where I was like, yeah, I really like, I got it right there.
You nailed it. I mean, you get right. You made her feel like her choice was meaningful, that she has power to make these choices rather than just sort of right, like go into all of the empathy of how sad and horrible it is when two people break up. No, sometimes it's a really happy occasion.
Yeah,
You
and
know, or, and it can be both, all right? I'm sure like it's a loss in many ways, but I'm sure she also made a good decision.
Well, and I started like a couple of years ago congratulating women generally when they told me they were getting divorces. And at first I thought I was being just sort of like cheeky and funny. But after a couple of years of doing it, it has only gotten positive responses of people saying, "Oh, like you really understand." So it's just
Especially
interesting.
because it's usually the women that are making the decision to leave. So, congratulations kind of are in order that they finally were able to listen to themselves.
Exactly. So like we should be proud of our daughters when they leave something behind and none of this messaging about like, oh, well, you might not get another chance with such a nice guy and
Oof,
you can't
yeah,
take that
that's
decision
so
back. It's like
harmful. Right, we
anybody who's
support.
ever like dealt with men knows that like they always come back. Like you usually can't get rid of that.
It is so true. And I think, like what you were saying, we're so quick to support dependency in girls, right? And if and that's what we're doing when we're like, oh, that's awful. I'm so sorry, Like, no, let's hear how they feel about it first. What went
Yeah.
into their decision, or what part, even if it was the boy that made the decision, what helped? What parts of that decision do they think are actually good? What's a relief? And so that we are showing them that we have confidence in their ability to be independent, to find a better relationship if that's what they want.
Well, and so we're getting like kind of into the generally talking to girls about sexism and relationships. And I think some listeners might be like, wait, but this was supposed to be about Donald Trump. But I think that we really need to seize these opportunities to help our kids understand the connection between their personal lives and their political lives. I have told kids I know, I'm worried about your ability to get birth control if Donald Trump gets elected. One of the things that I've been working on with my Republican readers is, well, you hate your husband and you want to leave, and a Trump administration wants to do everything they can to make it harder for you to leave. We have to help people understand that what seems like an individual personal problem is often a cultural problem, and cultural problems manufacture political problems, and there's a lot we can do about those.
Right. And in the same vein, I've talked to my kids about the, mental and emotional load when they've seen me explode or get upset or fight with my husband. I have said this is a personal problem. This is between us. And yet it's coming from the political sphere, right? There's not enough support for women, for childcare. And I want them to know that the personal is political.
Yeah, I really, and the thing that I'm constantly struck by is, especially, I haven't raised teenagers yet, but with my young children, I'm amazed how they basically arrive in the world as radicals, and we kind of beat it out of them. My 8-year-old is very much a prison abolitionist who thinks that no one should ever go to prison because it's just too awful for anyone. I think just presenting them with the facts and encouraging empathy is often all it takes. What we really find ourselves doing a lot is like undoing the indoctrination that we or society have already done.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. I think about that a lot of times in terms of like vegetarianism, where I have one kid who's a vegetarian and one kid who is a total meat eater, like
Oh
a,
no.
a carnivore. And yes, well, that's only the beginning of all the eating stuff, but we don't have to go there. And so
I know what
they,
that's like. We have vanity about
everybody
food in
likes
our
something
house.
different. But he was the same way when he was little. When he found out it was animals that we were eating, right, he was horrified. And but I could, but he's a very picky eater, and I could not figure out how to get protein in him. He wouldn't eat beans, he wouldn't eat tofu, right? And so it was like I had to sort of be like, well, we eat grass-fed blah blah blah, and it's just like such bullshit, and it's just right, sort of de-radicalizing him.
Yeah, it's so we have kind of a similar situation in our family. We are vegetarians. My oldest is a diehard vegan animal rights activist. And, she's often asking me, like, why aren't you vegan? And the answer is really because that's not the cause that I've chosen to like throw my full self into. And I only have so much I can do. And, I think it's sometimes useful for us to admit, like, it's because I'm not doing enough
Right.
for that cause. It's because
Yeah.
I'm
It's
not
because I
pure.
love cheese.
And I love cheese and I can't justify it. And I admit that that may be a moral failing. But, we live in a broken world and we're broken people who make it up.
And I, We can't be perfect, and we can't, for the most of us are doing the best we can, or the best we can at least moment to moment.
Yeah, and we just have to encourage ourselves to do better and encourage others to do better too. So on the point of perfectionism, I read this really interesting meme a couple of days ago. And I won't get it as punchy as the meme was, but it was something about how people who are raised in very punitive, very conservative religious cultures learn this black and white thinking. And then they grow up and they often abandon the religion and they join leftist politics, but they still have the black and white thinking of, if you don't have everything right, then you're bad. If you're not activism right, you're bad. And I think in reflecting on that, I think that's true from what I have seen with other people. And like, I want to be clear when I say not having everything right, I don't mean allowing racists into your social justice group. I mean, not knowing everything, not knowing what you're supposed to think and do. And I think that we need to make a lot of space in our conversations with our kids for getting things wrong and fixing it, both just in our parenting, but also in our talking about activism, so that they then have tolerance for that when they encounter other flawed people who are doing the best they can.
And I think you see in kids who are in kids who are learning about, maybe in school they're learning a lot of social justice, right? It's the parents that end up getting it quote unquote wrong, right? But they're just being human, or they're just, and they have learned these very, it's before the sort of abstract thinking of adulthood really kicks in, right? Kids can be, you can see it in kids, they can be really rigid about what's right and what's wrong. And sort of taking that into adulthood, which we are seeing, on the far right and the far left, is very destructive.
Yeah, I mean, so we're like, on the gentle, emotionally intelligent parenting bandwagon mostly. And I'll say to people things like, we don't believe in punishing our kids, or we don't believe in yelling at our kids. And I swear, my daughter will materialize out of nowhere and be like, well, actually, in May of 2022, you yelled at me and you made me cry. And it was punitive, so that's false. And
Let me
yeah,
pull out the ledger.
I swear she has one.
Oh
So
man.
it's wild raising kids, but
It
that's
is
a
such
whole
a
other
wild
topic.
ride. Yeah, you really realize how much you don't know.
Yeah, and I think that a little humility is good at this political moment. We don't know happen. And not knowing what's going to happen is scary, but it's also the truth. And I think it's better to say we don't know rather than to make decisive proclamations about all the terrible things that are going to happen. Also, like, I would just really encourage everybody to turn off the news and especially stop reading pundits who claim to know what's going to happen. It's wild how wrong these people constantly are. And yet they still have a platform that they use to scare people about what's happening next.
Right. And if we are in a state of panic, we are going to be much less effective, right? We are going to feel, right, like if despair overtakes hope, then we're really in trouble.
So I think that's where we need to leave it, is that as long as we are alive, there is hope. As long as we leave people alive after us, there is hope. Things change, and we need to be a part of changing them by supporting our kids to see things for what they are and for what they could be.